Sometimes I look up and I notice a dark cloud that comes with adulthood. And it's a dark cloud that it's over all of us, though I wonder how much it means to all of us, if that makes sense. Like, I truly believe that some people are simply ignorant to this dark cloud. And then there are others who run from it. And then there are others who just pretend it doesn't exist, but they know it's there. And then there are a great amount of us who process it and deal with it daily as best we can. It's something that I feel often, something that I've felt because of how, I guess, introspective I am and how much time I spend with myself in a watchtower, just looking out, looking out across my life and the people in it. And you know I'm an analytics guy, so I'm just truly analyzing our village, if you will. What I've noticed is a glaring connection between adult development and isolation, skepticism, defensiveness, and I guess just overall tension in general, aggression. And I stopped to look at myself because I'm trying to figure out why it was bothering me so much. And I think on one end, it's just because I'm just an analytical person. So I'm just always trying to understand how things work. It's just part of who I am. You know this. And then on the other hand, I would say that I am fairly fatigued by the aggressiveness and by the tension that our culture and society has developed around. But then, like, on my soul, like, the real soul question, the real soul issue is that, like, some of the softest people, and I don't mean soft in a term of, like, weakness. I mean soft as in gentle, as in welcoming, as in conversational, as opposed to divisive. Some of those people, some of those loving people, energetically fond people, kids that I've known from, you know, since the sandbox, have developed an innate ability to do some of the filthiest things. And I couldn't help but just think about the innocence that we had as children and how the process of shedding that innocence at the hands of adulthood, I guess how much damage that process can really do if it's, you know, not done correctly. Or maybe correctly isn't the word. Maybe the word is, maybe thoroughly. I don't know. We'll explore that a little bit more. But there's a journey that I've been very keen to over the last 7 years of adulthood for me. And that's just really processing, watching everyone, including myself, grow from these innocent kids into who we are today. Some of us, the journey's for the better. Some of us, we can use some work. Now, the point isn't to villainize growth or change or the journey of adulthood itself. It's simply to understand what makes us more divisive, what makes us more aggressive as we grow into these adults. Because even though, you know, we're adults in this form, 30 years from now, we're going to be a whole nother form of an adult. And then 30 years after that, be a whole nother form, you know? And you'd be surprised what we found in the research that points to how important it is to be able to handle those transitions between different stages of our lives with care, thoroughness, detail, and appreciation. Come to find out, becoming an adult without taking those necessary steps in between those stages, that can lead to cynicism, isolation, and a lot of other things that we see in society today. So we've got a lot to unpack, and I'm looking forward to it. We've got a lot of life ahead of us. The more we understand today helps us to walk this journey tomorrow. Let's go.
This is Live BW, episode 179, The Dark Cloud of Adulthood, Unwiring the Aggression. Let's explore. This is where we live.
Live in a beautiful state. Live in a beautiful state.
Dallas Ball, second and three at their own 18-yard line.
Second and who?
Three.
Turn it up, Stu. My ear's on the fritz.
Here's the snap. Dawkins dropping back to throw, but the pocket collapses around him. He's trapped in the backfield. Big Bubba Nagurski breaks through.
Looks like a sack for sure, Chick.
But wait, Kincaid's wide open at the line of scrimmage. Dawkins gets the ball off chest as Bubba smashes him to the ground.
Wow, what a shovel pass!
Sheer luck.
Man, I used to love this show so much. It reminds me of my childhood, obviously. Not even just the show, but, you know, I used to play the game as well on PlayStation. I actually remember renting it or my parents renting it from Blockbuster a long time ago. But nostalgia, it has its place in the world. In fact, if you look back on who you were as a child, who you were before you were introduced to the things that scare you, before you were introduced to the idea of survival, before you were introduced to the idea of somebody taking advantage of you, of getting over on you, being the victim of bad business, being fired for inexplainable reasons while working for an at-will employer, filing your taxes and finding out you owe an extra couple thousand dollars, failed investments. Think about the kid that you were before any of that was even a possibility. Relive how genuinely enthusiastic you were about just living, how enthusiastic you were about wallowing in a joy of just another day at the park, literally, like at the park or outside, you know, all the time you spent outside. Think about that. Those birthday parties, house full of 15, 20 people, all your friends kicking it. The mischievous little things you may have done that we ain't gonna tell nobody. You ain't got to worry about it. Your secret's safe with us, because I expect you not to tell my mom my secrets too. So we in this together. But think about those moments and just put yourself in that space again and feel how good it felt to not have that cloud of adulthood over your head. How good it felt to actually love before the heartbreak, you know? How good it felt to actually enjoy church before the church turned its back on you. Life is a cause and effect situation, and I'm not just talking out of my butt cheeks right now. This is literal science. Life is cause and effect. Experience turns us into who we are. Even deeper, how we deal with certain experiences, how we process certain experiences or don't process them, that turns us into who we are. And in some cases, with society the way that it is today, essentially it's like us going toe-to-toe with all sorts of different enemies at the same time, who every single day we wake up, something is trying to jab at us. That's a lot. That's a lot to manage. That's a lot of hits to take, even if you're able to parry a couple of them. Which, I mean, you know, as we get older, we get better at dealing with certain issues. It's just part of developing experience of life, if you will. But the ones that still land and still connect every now and then, not only do they sting from the first blow, but they also leave significant marks on our identity. And as someone who is analytical and loves to sit in the watchtower looking over things, that's the dark cloud of adulthood that I noticed, where essentially I watched myself and pretty much everybody that I grew up with curl up into a defensive adult, which in turn creates distance in the village. But I believe that within the science is the true answer of how to grow to be healthily skeptic adults while still being gentle and helpful to the village. Now, to begin to answer our hypothesis, we need to come back here, or we needed to come back here. It's a lot of babies in here, and we're here for obvious reasons, but I'll point it out just in case. This is the beginning spot for a lot of us. And even if it doesn't happen in this kind of situation, no matter where it happens at, it's a similar thing. A woman gave birth to you. Not only is that the beginning of our life, but even deeper, even more scientific, that's the beginning of our consciousness, the journey of our consciousness, if you will. Now, according to the United Nations, about 385,000 babies are born each day globally. That's a lot of kids. And the true poetry of it is this. That's 385,000 beginnings of new stories each day. Stories that will have, I mean, obviously the beginning, which is what we're talking about now, but stories that will have climaxes, stories that will have tragedy, stories that will have some form of success, okay? Triumph, trials, might as well be completely cliche and say tribulations, right? Stories filled with all sorts of things, 385,000 new ones every single day across the world. Now, at this moment of birth, we didn't know anything. We didn't even know what was happening around us. We have no clue. In fact, according to NIH, the newborn infant is conscious at a minimal level. That's according to Hugo Lagercrantz, who published The Emergence of Consciousness, Science and Ethics. He continued, "It is aware of its body, itself, and to some extent the outside world. It recognizes faces and vowels to which it has been exposed. It expresses emotions like joy. Functional magnetic resonance imaging of the newborn brain shows highest activity in the somatosensory, auditory, and visual cortex, but less activity in association area and the prefrontal cortex as compared with adults. There is an incomplete default mode network, which is assumed to be related to consciousness. Now, that means that a kid could be born into a family with $5 to its name and have no clue of the difference between growing up in poverty and growing up a millionaire. It could come into the world in the middle of a war and have no clue of what's going on outside of the hospital. It really honestly have no clue what's going on in the hospital either. It doesn't have a political preference, doesn't have a chip on its shoulder, hasn't had its heart broken. It honestly doesn't even know what love is. Us as newborns were just there, you know, for people to just stare at us and pinch our cheeks and do that weird little language that people be talking when they talk to babies. That's just about it. And even then, I don't know about you, but I don't remember any of like my first hour on Earth. I have no clue what that was like, you know. But life begins to happen, you know, as we mature and we start to, you know, experience different bumps and bruises, whether it's falling down while you're learning how to ride a bike, or maybe it was the first time you got popped, got whooped. Maybe you fell off the bed trying to jump from one bed to another. I don't know. But it's those little moments throughout our childhood that, they count, that shape us into, I mean, they just shape the rest of the journey, you know. But speaking specifically for childhood, Philip David Zelazo from the Department of Psychology at the University of Toronto wrote in 2004 on the development of conscious control in childhood. And he broke down the whole process of like what that looks like as a kid. As a kid develops into a personality, develops consciousness, if you will. And he broke it down into four stages over the years. And they conducted research by using something called LOC, or level of consciousness. And they analyzed the developmental data that suggests that the growth of executive function in childhood can be understood in terms of the development of consciousness. Now, these are the four stages that they broke it down to. They say on stage one, a child in this stage will begin adding depth to subjective experience through reflection. And I wish I had a memory or something that that I could recant right here. But if I had to imagine, this is the point of childhood when you start to realize that something ain't right. You can't necessarily explain it. It's like things happen and you feel that something is a little off and you just think about it. You know, just like something like what's this? What's this? What's going on? You know? And I wish that I had a specific memory, but I hope that even if you don't have a specific memory, you can kind of agree with me in kind of feeling what Philip Zelazo is talking about here. Now, stage two is when the information begins to process at a deeper and less superficial level. This is when the kid is really digesting what's happening to him or her and around him or her. And I think that, you know, this isn't in Zelazo's research, but I wouldn't be surprised if in stage two, this is when a child begins to question where they stand in the middle of all of this stuff that's happening around them. Who are they in reference to this current issue, if you will? Now, again, that's me. That's not Zelazo. So hold me accountable if you think that's incorrect. Stage three is where formulation and use of more complex knowledge structures happen. So now the kid's got an opinion. You might even say the opinion, might even speak on it, you know. And, you know, just like anything else, you're out there a little bit more, so you will make some mistakes a little bit more. In fact, Zelazo writes that character errors of executive function tend to happen here. And then the fourth stage is a complex processing of higher order or subordination. And I think that's a phase of a kid understanding that it truly is okay to walk in a single file line down the hall in elementary school. I remember that being such a big deal for me personally, where I was like, I don't necessarily care to do this right now. Even though most of the kids were behind me, because my last name starts with an A, my government last name. But walking in a line was just an issue for me until like the fifth grade, where I was like, this ain't so bad. I'm not tripping. Like, we could just make it to our destination. If we just get to the cafeteria so I can eat, I don't really care. It's all good. The fourth stage is like seeing that, okay, there's a flow to this thing. There's a flow around me. And it might be in my best interest to get in line with the flow right now. Now, I know that's a lot of information about childhood and infancy, things that we probably didn't even pay attention to. You know, we just walk through life without even really analyzing the code sometimes. But despite all of that interesting information, PDZ, or Philip David Zelazo, hope he appreciates the nickname. PDZ said something towards the end of his research that really stuck with me, and it was right on time and perfect for our little project that we're doing today. He suggests that this applies to adulthood as well. Now, that got me to thinking, how does it apply to adulthood? How do these stages look once we shed the innocence of childhood? And do we go overboard with it sometimes? What's different? We'll explore more on the other side. Hang out, baby. Live BW.
The journey of consciousness from childhood to adulthood is interesting, isn't it? Mr. Zelazo's research helps us understand how life is processed. Do you remember key points of your childhood that made you who you are today? Answer our Spotify survey and share your story. Brought to you by Spotify.
Unlike other health concerns, mental illness is not always easy to see. Depression won't show up on an eye chart, and you can't measure it on your bathroom scale. Sorting out a mental health concern is not something to attempt on your own. You won't find a bipolar disorder by looking at a thermometer. Like many other health conditions, help for mental illness takes professional diagnosis and treatment. Anxiety won't just go away under a stick-on bandage. So the sooner you seek treatment, the better. If you or a loved one has a mental health concern, don't go it alone. Find out what to do. For 24-hour free and confidential information and treatment referral, call 1-800-662-HELP. Learn more at samhsa.gov/support. That's samhsa.gov/support.
In some rooms, we're adults, and in other rooms, we're just big kids. All in all, we're people. We're heartbeats, bodies full of blood, veins. We're human. And the more that I explore life around us, the more I kind of see the similarities in between childhood and adulthood. It's just all about growth, about progression, about the process, about the journey. It's not necessarily about a specific destination. It's about climbing the ladder. You don't necessarily get off at any floor. You just keep climbing. And the goal is to climb as long as you can. So I thought it was very interesting when Mr. Zelazo echoed his research on the level of consciousness in children in reference to adulthood. Because just like those four stages that kids go through to kind of process things and learn how to find their response, ultimately enhancing their consciousness, it's got to be the same for us, right? There were certain things that shaped your political atmosphere. You felt a certain way when a politician from the other side of the aisle was speaking, and the things that they were alluding to, you weren't necessarily agreeing with. But it was a process, right? It was a process of understanding how you're feeling while said politician was delivering their remarks. And it may have even been a journey of, at first, maybe it enraged you, and then later on, you educated yourself and maybe it inspired you to develop your own voice in the conversation. And for some people, if you talk to a lot of politicians, that's actually how they get into politics. One thing seems inherently common from the day we leave the womb until this very moment that I'm spending with you right now. And that's, at every stage of life, we are just trying to learn how to process each day. Now, as I mentioned in the beginning, as we become adults, that's a lot to process. You got a lot to deal with, a lot to carry on your shoulders, a lot to work with in your soul and your mind. You got a home to look after, kids to look after. You got to make sure you eat and a bunch of different stuff. And naturally, you have to admit, it's a maze that loses people sometimes. In fact, according to Medicine Today, they say that some people become cynical, emotional, and behavioral crippling as they shed their innocence. That's pulled from a 2005 piece published by John Scott, who titled it, "When Innocence is Lost, We React in Different Ways." Now, Medicine Today highlights in the key points of the article, they say, loss of innocence is a normal feature of the progression from childhood through adolescence to adulthood. In the ideal circumstances of a caring family, the change is handled thoughtfully without any damage being sustained. Humor, friendly leg pulling, and many subtle educative processes may contribute. Now here's the other part. Some young folk are not so lucky. The outcome may be the sudden or gradual development of cynicism and the dangerous form of skepticism. Loss of innocence may thus result in emotional and/or behavioral crippling. So you remember earlier how I said how important it is to kind of just let the growth happen organically, and more importantly, especially for you listening, or for us, I should say, as adults, because we're kind of at the phase now where we're also training up a generation or generations behind us. What John Scott is hinting at here is how important it is to have support of the village and also have support for yourself as you're experiencing these changes in life. Now, what happens is some people have issues with processing these changes, or they don't have the support when trying to process these changes. And that's what kind of pushes them into like an area of isolation, if you will, or to use their phrase, cynicism, skepticism, emotional and/or behavioral crippling. There was a point in time in my life, especially in my career, where I was just like, hey, if I could just buy it, let's do it. I'll cut the line and just buy it. But now I understand, and in relation to our topic here, it's better to just let things happen organic. Don't force it. Don't force the atmosphere. If it's going to rain, it's going to rain. If the sun's going to shine, the sun's going to shine. My top five favorite go-go band of all time, Peculiar People, had a song that said Dance in the Rain. I'll never forget it because of what it did for my soul, you know? Because it's true. You got to learn to dance in the rain because you can't just look up at the sky and say stop, you know? Just learn to deal with it, you know? Learn how to be in the midst of the storm. That skill of dancing in the rain, if you will, I don't know if that's something that everyone can do. And in most cases, that's when the village comes in. That's when we're supposed to be there for each other, you know? But some people just didn't have any of that. And that's how they became isolated and skeptic and all of the above. So what is it that makes the process of shedding innocence so tough for us as adults? Well, to be honest, I couldn't necessarily find a specific answer because I don't think there is one particular answer. I think it's different for everybody. Rick, if you're listening, you're going to get upset when I say this, but this is one of those things that falls into my everything is relative category. And that's simply based on the fact that our DNA is different, we're wired different. So the things that I struggle with as I transition between childhood to adolescence to adulthood are going to be different challenges for you and for other people because we're different. It is what it is. So there is no particular answer, at least in my book. And I couldn't find one in the research. But I did find some research to support a theory that I've had for quite some time, mostly most of my adult life. But a theory that I've had that I want to call the gauntlet theory. And the best way I can lay this out is by telling a story that has to do a lot with this song right here, which I love.
I don't mind letting you down easy, but just give it time. If it don't hurt now, but just wait a while. And let the big fish in the pond no more. You were what they're feeding on. So what are you gonna do when the world don't open up?
Because we all love Paramore, right? We all love Haley. That's the homie. But it reminds me of one of the biggest cliffs that I've jumped off of when moving from adolescence to adulthood. And ironically, it's essentially the same story as what I told on the last episode, but I'm going to say a little further into the journey, if you will. And that was that jump that I took when I moved to Buffalo. I was an adult, almost 1,000 miles away from home, for the first time in my life. And like I told you last week, making that decision was scary as hell. But what I didn't mention is that while I was in the middle of that decision-making process, trying to decide if I was going to take this risk, if you will, I kept hearing this song, I mean, everywhere. Like, I would go to the mall, this place called Arundel Mills, and I specifically remember going into the bathroom, and the song came on in the speakers. You know, then I would get in the car, and I would listen to the station that I love to listen to in D.C. called Hot 99.5. I would listen to them. They would play it all the time. I go to Dunkin' Donuts, it'd be on. Starbucks, like just random places like that, this song would be on. Now, yes, on one hand, it did a really good job of promoting the record, so it's probably why it was everywhere. But on the other hand, I really stopped to listen to the lyrics, and I really delved into the lyrics to see what the hell they were singing about and why it made me feel a certain way every time I would hear the song. It starts with, I don't mind letting you down easy, but just give it time. If it don't hurt now, then just wait a while. You're not the big fish in the pond no more. You are what they are feeding on. And then the bridge, so what are you gonna do? I didn't have to sing it, let me keep reading it. So what are you gonna do when the world don't orbit around you? So what are you gonna do when the world don't orbit around you? Ain't it fun living in the real world? Ain't it good being all alone? Now that's just the first verse, the bridge, and the chorus. I don't think I'm going to read the rest of it. We'll see how I feel in about 5 minutes or so. But that song is about coming into adulthood. It's about that jump or that cliff between adolescence and adulthood. And it was just odd to me because the song was released in 2013, which is right around that time where I was just a few months away from making the move from my hometown of Bowie, Maryland to Buffalo, New York. And even the title of the song, Ain't It Fun? It's sarcastic. No, it's not fun. None of this is fun. It's not fun. And in fact, Haley and Paramore knows it's not fun. They tell you it's not fun in the first couple of lines. I don't mind letting you down easy, but just give it time. If it don't hurt now, then just wait a while. You're not the big fish in the pond no more. You are what they're feeding on. That's adulthood. They're sarcastically asking you, ain't it fun to make this jump into the real world? No, it is not fun. And circling back around, which means I won't have to read the rest of the lyrics, sadly, but circling back around, that pain that Haley is talking about, the pain of the coming of age into adulthood, this pain right here is a fork in the road for a lot of us, where some people walk down a path that turns into a dark alley that leads them to the cynicism that John Scott was talking about in Medicine Today, that emotional and behavioral crippling that he was mentioning. Some people become outrageously defensive about everything because of this dark alley, this isolating alley of adulthood, of life, where you feel like everything is against you. Because we went through what I call the gauntlet theory, which is reminiscent to a drill that we used to run in football, where you're just running through what's called the gauntlet and everybody's just hitting you, just tearing you up. You go through the gauntlet theory, and even in football, some people don't make it all the way through the gauntlet. They fall, they trip, they take the helmet off, they go home, and like, I don't want to deal with this today. It's the same thing in life, you know? As we become adults, life begins to happen, and there's no one else to carry our burdens. We begin to experience social, spiritual, romantic, financial, health, and career pain, along with this quote-unquote expectancy of knowing how to deal with it. And I say quote-unquote because that expectancy is an illusion, if you will. I actually don't think that a lot of our loved ones are expecting us to be perfect at carrying a lot of this mess. That's the whole point of the village, so that you don't have to carry it by yourself. But we'll talk about that a little later because I actually have some research to back that theory up as well. To sum all of that up, the gauntlet theory puts us through hell, a shocking hell of adulthood, of realizing that you're not the big fish in the pond no more, you are what they're feeding on. Shout out to Paramore. Realizing that the world don't orbit around you, shout out to Paramore again, and seeing that it's actually not fun living in the real world. It's a lot of work to find the fun, to find the sunshine, to find the happiness in the midst of the clouds. And that gauntlet theory creates a fork in the road, which in some cases creates responsible adults, and in other cases creates skeptic, cynical adults who each live their journeys out until that great day. Now, if my theory is true, which, I mean, the science lines up, right? psychological side of things matches up, but we'll just say if, then that would really make sense or matches up with this research that I found from BetterHelp, which highlights how pain affects our character development, affects our development in general. It's an article written by their editorial team, and it was actually written this year, January of this year. It says, "Understanding Emotional Agony and How It Changes Us." And if we look at all of the research and the work that we've done today, it really highlights, well, what happens when we go through the gauntlet theory in adulthood, or as we develop as adults. Now, the authors break it down into two emotional responses, if you will. The first one is emotional pain, which is essentially the everyday pain of resistance. So, like, for example, let's just say you woke up today and you didn't want to go to work, but you know good and well you don't have any options. You gotta go. The bag isn't going to make itself, and more importantly, those lights are not powered by magic. You gotta pay the company to, you know, give you some power. Or even more importantly, you gotta eat, you know, so you gotta go to work. But maybe you woke up today and really didn't want to go to work. You just want to not even lay in the bed. You just want to just not have to deal with the responsibilities of going to work. You having to go, you'll sit at your desk with this feeling in your stomach and your soul. That's the emotional pain. That's just everyday pain. Now, I use this word in my notes, but I just said resistance. Just feeling that resistance of having to do something that you don't necessarily want to do. Now, the other one is far more serious, according to their research here, and that's called emotional agony. Now, they highlight this as severe emotional pain, and they say that it's long-term with no easy solution. And I would add on to that that, you know, maybe it's like the recurring emotional pain. It just keeps on coming up, and you never really address it or address how to, like, the better we get with handling the things that cause us that emotional pain, that temporary, that like quick hit pain, if you will, the better we get with managing those things and setting the boundaries that are necessary to kind of alleviate that stress, alleviate that pain, if you will, the better we get at that, the more likely we are to prevent it from metastasizing into emotional agony, if you will. Which, if it does, I mean, that's not necessarily a death sentence, but according to BetterHelp, it is tougher to deal with. And it does leave a more significant mark on our character development, on who we are, and can cause a lot of problems, as you can imagine. In fact, BetterHelp writes that emotional agony tends to affect and change the whole person, from our values and outlook on life to how we treat others. They continue, "Emotional agony is a type of severe psychological pain that some of us may experience at some point in our lives. For a short or extended period of time, it can manifest itself differently for each person, but it may lead to changes like these: feeling sad, stressed, etc., mood swings, low energy, poor sleep, changes in appetite, anxiety or depression, trouble maintaining or forming relationships, risky behavior like gambling, unprotected intercourse, and etc." Now, a lot of those flags, if you will, are things that would be considered red flags when you talk to any mental health expert. And, you know, if you're dealing with anything like that, you can always email me. I love to help people find help for these situations, because I know that therapy and mental health professionals, I mean, they've been my saving grace, you know. So you can just email me at brian@brianjameslive.com, and I will personally help you find someone that can help you deal with this emotional agony, if you will. But if you are experiencing any of those things, now you can put a name on it. Now you can nominate it as what BetterHelp calls emotional agony. And they also continue in this report, they lay out the common causes of it, if you will. And when I look at this list, it doubles back to the whole just adulthood thing. Just things that you don't necessarily notice are happening around you when you are under the umbrella of childhood innocence. Things that as you come up from under that umbrella, you start to realize and you start to see what's really going on, and these things start to happen in your life. I mean, this list is full of it. And they list five common causes of emotional agony, and they are the following. Number one is loss. They say it's otherwise known as grief. One of the most common types of emotional agony is the agony of losing someone close to us, they say. Most people go through the process of grief at some point in life, though for some, grief can strike early and often. Now, they're speaking specifically about losing a loved one. I would even take it a step further to say that losing anything, losing your car, you know, losing a job, losing an opportunity, losing a kid, you know, the kid didn't pass away, but maybe you lost your kid into the system, or maybe went through a nasty divorce, and you know, just it's just all sorts of details that go into different stories of people who are dealing with emotional agony. And as listed here, one of the top causes, well, I guess if they're in numerical order here, then the top cause is loss. The second one is mental illness, and they list bipolar disorder, depression, personality disorders, and others. And they say that people that kind of deal with these things are the ones that may experience emotional agony more frequently than others. And again, I would say that's a conversation that should be had between a patient and a mental health professional to really diagnose and to treat that. But dealing with that and carrying that, it can lead to emotional agony. The third is physical illness, a physical pain. The basketball player who fractured his leg and can't finish the season may not even be able to come back to play sports. The dancer who broke her ankle just before the big recital. The person who keeps feeling this nagging pain in their neck and can't help but be concerned or be nervous or be anxious about the potential of it being something bigger than just a nagging pain. BetterHelp says that all of those things may contribute to an ongoing mental and emotional concern, which in turn could create emotional agony, if you will. The fourth is regrets. And I would sum all of this up just by saying being married to the past, reliving all of those mistakes from college, reliving the mistake that you made last week or even earlier today when you feel like, you know, you had your opportunity to have this big conversation and it didn't go your way. Holding on to what's already happened and creating an jail cell for you to just walk around banging your head against, thinking about the regretful moments that cause you pain. Staying in that prison, staying in that jail cell creates that emotional agony because it's just recurring emotional pain. You just continue to deal with it, never really process it, but you know, you just face it. In fact, BetterHelp says, quote, whether you did something on purpose that you now feel is wrong, or it was an accident that you feel you could have prevented, living in past regrets can lead to extended periods of emotional agony. And then number five, and the last one on the list, is rejection and failure, which as they highlight in this blurb here, which is an interesting word, most of us feel that, you know, especially I know for me personally, that rejection has always been a tough pill for me to swallow, if you will, because I've always been too churchy for a lot of people and too a lot of people for the church. You know, I've even been in some rooms where it's like, you know, you don't have enough culture. You know what I'm trying to say, you ain't black enough. And then in other rooms it's like, well, you're too black, you know. This one hits home for me because even to this day it's something that I had to deal with. I mean, even in some of the circles that that I frequent, for whether it's, you know, work related or whether it's social organizations, things that I kind of have a responsibility to but don't necessarily have a identity with, if that makes sense. And you feel that rejection, you know, but that, and it does cause an emotional pain in me. But thanks to therapy, thanks to a concerned effort to address that emotional pain whenever it comes up, I try not to let it grow into emotional agony. But as BetterHelp highlights, for some, the feeling of rejection can lead to a feeling of emotional agony that is ongoing. And as you can imagine, that can push you into isolation, and you know how dangerous that is. Now, BetterHelp lists four ways they think that you can fight this, or as they say, how to rise above it and actually benefit from emotional agony. They say, one, you can live in the moment. Quote, you may be familiar with the many benefits of mindfulness. When it comes to overcoming emotional agony, mindful habits can help bring you back to the present moment and what you can control. It may also help you consider what things in life you appreciate or are grateful for, which can be both motivating and comforting. And I can say that this does work. Because for me, a lot of my emotional pain comes from situations and things that I cannot control. So I have to sit there and remind myself of what I can control. It's complicated, but I can say that as I was making this transition between adolescence and adulthood, that's part of this. This was part of my struggle. But now that I've gotten more experience with adulthood, I have found my footing and found a way to, quote, rise above and benefit from that emotional agony, if you will. The second on their list is they say reach out, which, as I mentioned before, you have my email address if you need to talk to somebody. Now, again, I'm not a licensed therapist. I'm not a professional at this. I'm just someone who has walked this journey before and is willing to share their story. But they say, quote, emotional agony can quickly lead to isolation, which can lead to even further emotional agony. When you begin experiencing severe emotional pain, one of the best things you can do is to make it known, whether to a trusted friend or counselor, which I recommend both personally. But they continue, often just saying the words out loud or writing them down, which I also recommend, I have multiple journals, can take much of the power out of the pain you are experiencing. And this plays into our conclusion here, which just hold on to that. Just hold on to that. The third on this list is to let go of the blame. This ties into the regret too, of like just the past, you know, things that people are walking around with and approaching other people, approaching relationships with these quote unquote, you've heard this before, chips on their shoulders. That grooms a defensive society as well, because a lot of people are stepping into, a lot of us, I should say, are stepping into these arenas and into these conversations and into these relationships with all sorts of blame that we're trying to be defensive against, with all sorts of regret that we're trying to make up for, the forgiveness that we never gave ourselves or the others in our lives. It just creates that baggage that just weighs on the tongue when we talk to people, weighs on the mind when we listen to people, you know? BetterHelp says forgiving yourself or someone or something who has wronged you can be key in terms of overcoming emotional agony. Forgiveness is not about forgetting about what happened, but rather it's about letting go of the things that you cannot change. And then the last one is to get proactive. And basically they're alluding to committing to a strategy to create happiness in your life, which I can honestly say is beautiful. Like for me, I know the things that I need to put a smile on my face. Now, the key is to not go overboard with it. But for me, you know I'm a gamer. So if I need an hour to play a game, to go into my just world where none of this mess matters, I'm going to come back and deal with it later. But if I need it, I'm going to take it. I know it puts a smile on my face and I know it helps my soul, you know? Or spending time with my lady. How much joy that brings me. Spending time with my family, with my little brother, laughing about nothing, just how much joy that brings me. I was able to identify those things and others, it's a lot of things, but I was able to identify those things and develop a strategy because I committed to being proactive to do so, you know? And granted, I still have hellish days. Like, I am not mentioning this as some sort of mountaintop speech. I'm just saying that it works. BetterHelp says, while understanding that some emotional pain and even emotional agony may be unavoidable, developing a strategy to create happiness in your life can be useful. Often, we take happiness for granted and assume that it's something that should fall in our lap, when in fact, happiness is often hard-earned through work and perseverance. Now, another way to alleviate the emotional agony that we face as learning adults is to realize how much of an illusion that quote-unquote expectancy that I mentioned earlier, that expectancy of carrying all of this on your own, realizing how much of an illusion it actually is. We tend to think that everybody got their eyes on us in the village, that everybody is expecting us to do absolutely everything to tip-top perfection. For some of us, it may have been because of how we were raised, you know? For others, it may be because of just an overestimation of the weight of people's opinions. I'm guilty of this, 100%. And I realize it every time that I look at my plate and the things that I have to deal with each day and the hats that I'm trying to wear and say, man, I'm just trying to do too much. And then you add on top of it the concern of, you know, people are watching. It has to be perfect. I have to do this, that, and the third. Me and Ashley were just talking the other day about the hyper-perfectionism that goes into publishing this content sometimes, you know, and how detrimental that perfectionism actually can be. It's crippling. It's paralyzing. You spend so much time trying to make everything right and perfect that you end up not making anything at all. The expectancy of success is a heavy burden, but it's not real. Even if it does exist, and I mean, we all have different situations, you don't have to carry the burden alone. You don't. There's a village out there for us. We are the village. We create the village or villages around our interests, around our passions, around our fears. We curate a village that is here to help us. It's an illusion. You don't have to do it by yourself, and you don't have to do it perfect. Finding our village, nurturing our village, supporting and serving our village is the key to everything today. It's the solution. And I have research that supports why on the other side.
The results are in. 100% of participants in our Twitter survey say that they can recall a memory that impacted their adult life. See the results on Twitter at BJamesLive. Our solution to today's hypothesis is coming up next on LiveBW.
Every year, over 1 million fires burn in America. Fortunately, firefighters are on the job, saving life and property, and you can be a part of it. 7 out of 10 firefighters and emergency responders are volunteers. There's no typical firefighter. Anyone can volunteer to serve their community. Volunteering as a first responder is really about having the heart and drive to make a difference where it's needed most. Your community needs you. Are you ready to answer the call? Learn more and find local volunteer opportunities at makemeafirefighter.org.
Live in a beautiful state.
So, the solution is in the village. Remember that. The solution is in the village. I keep saying that to myself, and I'm gonna keep saying it to myself too, because I love the fact that it was in the research, and it took time to rebuild my village after I fell into a hole of isolation and the cynicism that we've been speaking of on today's episode. It took time to rebuild it, but it's worth it, and it was worth it, and it always will be worth it, because even the research shows how important it is to have a village. According to Science Daily, professors at Flinders University conducted a study in December of 2020 that shows that defensiveness in response to wrongdoing is exacerbated by making the wrongdoer feel like they're an outcast. Maybe this quote will help. Associate Professor Woodyatt says, "This research shows that defensiveness is strengthened by negative social responses, but is reduced when people feel secure in their group identity, respected, and valued." Professor continues, "Based on our research over the past several years, our recommendations for reducing defensiveness when dealing with someone who may have done something wrong is to emphasize respect and value for the person, even if you disagree with their views or actions. Also, provide an opportunity for the person to express their values prior to talking about the specific problem." Now, how they came to this conclusion is that they examined defensiveness in response to interpersonal transgressions and, quote, perceived ethical violations. In other words, it just watched a bunch of people who were in the gauntlet theory, essentially, but more so like the social version of that. And they noticed how people were open, people opened up more, if you will, as they started to rotate with their village. Or in their words, as they started to feel, quote, secure in their group identity, respected, and valued. And so the best way to combat the defensive nature that the adjustment period between childhood, adolescence, to adulthood creates is by creating, nurturing, and being present in your village. Group identity. And it's hard. It really is. It's tough. Because one thing you'll know for sure by listening to this podcast is just how fascinating human nature is, in so much that it's so many different people that walk this earth, all across the earth, into so many different things, just wide ranges of things. That, you know, the positive side of that is that I do believe that there's a village for everybody, but with so many options and so many opportunities and so much noise, it is tougher, especially in 2023, to find that village. So in some cases, it may feel like, you know, you got to be defensive. You got to have a defensive nature as some sort of extension of a pursuit of survival. But the key to today's research and study and conversation, if you will, is that life is heavy and it gets heavier. The more adulting we do, the heavier this whole thing gets. We're not kids anymore. We're not allowed to just come home after school, do our homework, and just eat whatever food is on the table, go to sleep and play in the morning and do whatever and not have to pay a bill, not have to deal with the fact of, okay, I got this amount that I need to divvy up between blank, blank, blank. I'm trying to save up for this, trying to deal with that, da, 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 da. The politics at work, legal troubles, all of that. We're not allowed to just, there is no umbrella to stand under anymore. And the rain of adulthood, it certainly is heavy. When it rains, it pours. You've heard it. It's on the side of the salt, the Morton salt can. That's literally what it says. At least I think it still says that. Life is heavy and it gets heavier by the day. The training wheels are off, but developing community, communities around us or a village, that's what helps us to fend off the crippling defensiveness and bitterness. Find your village, nurture your village, be present in your village, and know that, no, we're not kids anymore, but we can still smile. Peace and love. God bless.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode. Thank you to our experts today. BetterHelp, Medicine Today, John Scott, Science Daily, NIH, University of Toronto, Flinders University, Hugo Lajerkrantz, Professor Philip Zelazo, and you, of course. To recap, visit brianjameslive.com/podcast. For Brian James, I'm Cora. We'll see you next time.